Hello, everyone. Thank you for watching another episode of The Naturalist Capitalist. This is your host, Reed Coverdale. I'm very excited to have Siraj Hajmi on the other end. How are you doing tonight, Siraj?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Sounds good to me.
How you doing, Reed? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, man, I really appreciate it. I had no fucking clue who you were until I ended up on the list. So do you want to just start out with that? Tell us what the list is. When did you come up with that? Why did you do it? And what is it?
Well, first of all, Reed, welcome to the club of not knowing who the fuck I am until you actually get on the list. That's kind of my brand now. I could swear on this podcast, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. Fuck yeah. Let's go. So, you know, the list came up back in December of 2019, and it had to do with, you know, the constant public bickering that happened between George and Kellyanne Conway. Kellyanne Conway, who was then the, I would say, the senior advisor to President Trump, and also her husband, George Conway, who at that time, I think, had already launched the Lincoln Project. So we're looking at December 2019. And what I'm seeing from the two, so to give you a long story short, you had the Trump whistleblower Ukraine impeachment inquiry ongoing, and Kellyanne Conway was trying to dunk on Joe Biden by tweeting out something along the lines of like just sort of like a bumbled clip of Biden going, I don't know, you know, doing Biden stuff. And she tweeted something along the lines of like, we need Ukraine's help to beat this guy. And then George Conway quote tweeted her saying, your boss apparently thought so, to which I was like, oh, hold the fuck up here. Even if you are married, okay, I don't know what the situation is between you two, but don't dunk on your wife in public. So I was just like, we need to get your phone stat, George. So I put George Conway what was called a power ranking of people who need their phones taken away. It was never called the list originally. And I started doing this. I had a top five. It was George Conway at number one, Donald Trump at two, because almost every day he had his phone taken away. I think I was at like number three, or I had like Charlie Kirk or Seth Mandel. Seth and I clown each other around all the time because we worked at the Examiner together. And I was on the list. So there was a top five only. And so what ended up happening from that is just like almost every day after that, we had basically done a top five for maybe the first week. And maybe like on day three, one of my colleagues, Jason Russell, and good friend, he wrote in response to one of the lists. He said, "At them, you coward." I was like, all right, fine. I guess I'll start putting, you know, their Twitter handles on it. Started doing that. And I expanded from 5 to 10. It was a daily thing. And of course, I started using the writing hand emojis, and I took inspiration from there's a very popular account on Twitter called Freezing Cold Takes, or Old Takes Exposed, really exposing all the sports takes that are just freezing cold. They're just like all the predictions that just fall to shit. And, you know, I was messaging the guy who runs that account, and I was like, would you ever consider doing politics? And he's like, no, I stay out of politics like entirely. Like, that's just not my lane. And I was like, well, if you ever think about doing that, just let me know. I'd be happy to help. I love what you're doing. I think it's really, really creative and really fun. And then it just sort of happened. Like, I fell into it accidentally, where it was just like the list became a thing, where it went from daily to then weekly. And then we started having tournaments and shit, and people started buying into it. They were just like, this is a really like interesting concept where people are finding just the bad takes on Twitter or the bad tweets on Twitter and just pointing and laughing at them. And sometimes these takes could be really egregious. They could be really ghoulish. Sometimes they just be like straight up stupid or cringe. And so we started creating different categories, and we now have like a certain echelon in which kind of, it's like a, are you familiar with golf, Reed, and how like people kind of like always play and try to, you know, beat their best score? Like, everyone's playing against themselves. So like, I'm trying to beat my previous score from the last round. that's basically how the list works. So like the best person, the queen of the list, Jennifer Rubin, like how do you top those types of tweets? Like the ones that are just so mind-numbingly dull and make you have an aneurysm just right up front from reading them. Like the most Jennifer Rubin tweet of all time is her responding to Andrew Cuomo saying the boyfriend looks nice and the girls look like they ate their spaghetti and meatballs. Like, what the fuck, Jen? Come on. So it's just become like one of those things, like how can you outdo yourself? And so like for some people, the threshold remains low, but it starts to raise up. And there's like a method to the madness. There's a method to the listness.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of these people, they're charlatans, right? Like they're just saying stupid shit that they don't believe. Do you think the list kind of brings that out in people, shows who's actually just being retarded on purpose versus who's actually dumb?
Actually, you know, what's interesting is I had to refine some of my qualifications and the threshold for what makes a list, because I have to take into account some levels of trolling because I know when people are trying to make the list.
Right.
And say, for example, with your tweet, because you made the list for your name a better upgrade. I'm like, holy fuck. Like, this is the spiciest tweet I think I've ever seen.
I'll bring it up. Screen in a second.
Yeah, so. Bring it up in just a moment. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, I had never encountered you before, so like I have no baseline for you. So I'm thinking, all right, if he is being completely serious, then I have to take him at his word on his tweet that he is being serious, and therefore this tweet is worthy of the list. Because even if he's completely serious, or if he's being a troll, which I assume you probably were, be I mean, having gotten to know you over the last few days, weeks, and kind of seeing how you tweet, if I had known you before that tweet, I probably would not put it on the list.
Oh, wow. That means I've gotten really bad.
Well, but like, that's the thing, is like, you have to, like, you set a baseline and then you start establishing a pattern. And once I finally figure out what that pattern is, then I have a good summary of like how spicy your takes are going to be. And you have to outspice all of your takes in order to get back on the list, basically. Like, you basically have to like call for like, you have to like wish death on somebody at this point, Reed.
Well, if I can figure this out again, I'm going to bring the tweet up that made the list so everyone can see it. I think most people have seen this who follow me by now. Let's see. Tab this one. Think. Is it showing up?
Yeah, that's showing up.
There it is. So this isn't completely dishonest. I hate McCain's guts and I'm glad he's gone. It's definitely heartless. It's definitely in bad taste. It definitely was to invoke a reaction. But I've made a lot of these types of tweets about neocons. Like, I made one. Oh man, well, I should have found it and screenshotted it, but it was toward Dan Crenshaw when he was saying like, we can never pull out of Afghanistan. We have to stay there forever. And I mean,
that's a bad take.
Yeah. Like it was something like this that I did. I did one to George W. Bush, or no, to Liz Cheney, saying that, you know, she likes presidents who don't, I like Republican presidents who get reelected, and it was a picture of George Bush. So under it,
that was a cringeworthy tweet.
And then Meghan McCain quote tweeted it with a bunch of, you know, flame emojis. So then I said, "Do the flames represent the burning bodies of all the innocent children in Baghdad?" And I almost ratioed her. But I mean, this is just like, this is the way I go after neocons. So I don't know. I mean, it's certainly, I'm not going to defend it as, you know, humane or nice or.
Right. No, I totally get what you're saying. I totally get what you're saying. I mean, politics is a dirty business. And, you know, there are some people who have the stomach for it, and there are a lot of people who don't. And, you know, this idea of like, you know, that there's like an elite group of politicians who, no matter what party they are still friends in the end. And there are definitely some, I'd say, within who are kind of like coming up into this, and or maybe even like late to the game, understanding how this whole system works and understanding how corrupt it is, because it all seems very seedy, incestuous, even that, you know, they, you could have senators, members of Congress basically deliberating about like matters of life and death, and then go out for dinner and drinks afterwards. Like it's like just another day at the office. Like there's a part of you that feels sort of sick to your stomach, yeah, because these things are obviously, these affect people's lives. And especially on the matters of war, it is insane to me how reckless our politicians can be in sending our men and women to another country in the name of fighting for freedom and just say, oh, that's, you know, it needs to be done. Like, yeah, I mean, this is the part where like I always get, you know, there are a lot of things that are crazy that happen in politics, and I've sort of been all over the place, because the only time I was ever at a protest in my life was when I was 15 years old, and it was protesting the Iraq War in 2003. And mm-hmm. I skipped school to go to an anti-war protest in West Hartford, Connecticut, where I was going to high school. Of course, preceding that, I was living in Lahore, Pakistan for about 6 years, and my family and I had to evacuate after 9/11. Because the Taliban and Al-Qaeda put a bounty on all American heads in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So while it didn't feel like my life was threatened at all, you know, sort of like the hastiness of trying to leave and then going back like 4 months later, I got as close to Afghanistan while the U.S. was still at war with Afghanistan and finding Osama bin Laden. I had gotten as close as Peshawar, which is a border city in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan that shares a border with Afghanistan. It is arguably like it's almost like there's no border there. It's like the most porous thing you've ever seen. But we went to several refugee camps there, Afghan refugee camps, and you know, try to figure out ways so we could help. My dad is like he's a saint, and I will defend him to the death. And he's a heart surgeon, and he just like took all of us out there to go figure out ways how we could go help. So we basically started, you know, funding these schools and refugee camps. And it's one of those things where when you see it, it really leaves an impression on you. And I know we're going to probably be talking about a lot of Afghanistan stuff, but like when I think about like, say, how neocons have really fucked up the country, they are the original reason why I ever got involved and engaged in politics, is because of the Iraq War. The Afghanistan War for me, I guess, was a little bit different, but I guess over time, you know, that really started to sour. And, you know, then we have everything that happened in August with the withdrawal, and that, you know, that unfortunately it should not, something like that should affect everyone, some harder than others. But I feel like I almost get even more upset at the amount of apathy and indifference that some people have towards these catastrophes that happen, you know, across the world. Like, sure, you may not know that person, and you may not know the people of Afghanistan, but like you ever go there and you know, meet with the people, they're just like you and me. They're just trying to, you know, work, feed their families, raise children who end up being upstanding citizens. Like, they didn't ask for this shit. And the United States just comes in here and just fucking ruins everything. And it's just, that is the one thing that I still can't get behind with, you know, a lot of people think I'm conservative, a lot of people think I'm a Republican. Like, I never voted for a Republican. And, I, you know, it's actually kind of the one thing that ever for that will probably forever prevent me from becoming a Republican is how neocons still basically control the Republican establishment.
Yeah. I mean, what you're talking about, like, I don't know if you want to call it American exceptionalism or American arrogance or just American ignorance. You know, I mean, they just, most people, they don't care at all about anything that we do around the world. And it's because it's separate from them. Like, if they have to see it, they don't like it. It was kind of crazy. Like, when the, you know, when the troops were pulling out of Afghanistan, suddenly Americans cared about the dogs we left behind or whatever, because that was something they had to see and that they had to deal with because they saw an image that made them feel bad. And it's like, don't you realize this type of stuff is happening to people all the time, all around the world, and you never gave a shit? And that's actually, that's why I do the neocon posts, because what's interesting is the outrage that they spark from people. Not even all the people are neocons who get angry at me, but they're just like, how dare you say this? Like, how dare you make a joke out of this? And I mean, the reason I do it is because we just live in, we just live in this disconnected world where for me to make that post is just so taboo and so ridiculous. But for Liz Cheney or John McCain, when he was a senator, for any of these fucking neocons, they could say, we need boots on the ground and we need to take over this place and we need to do this targeted airstrike that ends up killing 11 innocent children or whatever. Like, we need to do all these things and there's no questions asked. You know, like, this is for your this is for your greater good. This is to protect democracy around the world. This is to forward our agenda. And none of it was ever like really questioned. Like, you know, I mean, the Iraq war with George Bush was sort of like a sort of an anomaly. Like, there was actually like some mainstream pushback to it. But since then,
you talk about the Gulf War, the first one,
the second one. And like, there was actually some mainstream opposition to it. Not a lot. But since then, like, there's been nothing. I mean, all the wars that Obama started, the wars that continued under Trump, like, there was no opposition to it at all. So
yeah, one thing that really, like, just the fact that, like, it's almost cherry picking at this point. Like, if the corporate media hates the president, they're gonna find the stories that if the previous president had done, they'd never cover because it looked too bad on them. Like, say for example, The drone war in Afghanistan and Pakistan was probably, it was expanded under Obama, continued under Trump, still exists under Biden. Yet every time it's covered, they make sure that it's only negative against Trump. And if it happens under Biden, like with this particular drone strike in Afghanistan during the withdrawal, you know, they say, oh, it's unfortunate collateral damage or like, but the media doesn't respond to it. Like, where are the fucking resignations? Where is the justice? You killed a whole fucking family, 7 children, 10 innocent people. I mean, it's just, it starts to get to you because at this point, and I feel like almost every single day, Reed, I'm being gaslit. I feel like the government only exists to drive me insane. And they do it to try to increase their own power, because then once they finally push me to the brink of insanity, then they can use the justification. See, Siraj is insane and there are many people like Siraj. Therefore, you need to give us more power to protect us from ceding power to people like him. That's basically kind of the struggle I think that America is in right now. But also, I think we as a society have just been so desensitized to this shit that when you see a drone strike on television during, like, say, the 6 o'clock news with your family, it's just like, oh, it's too bad. Anyways, how's your day, Jimmy? Like, that's like the level of, like, where we've gone as a society. And it's terrible. Like, we as a society just lack empathy for other people. And we only are able to get enough empathy to basically, you know, care about the things that advance our own agenda or advance our own narrative. And that's where the virtue signaling comes into play. And like, you know, you once you see it, and once you see through it, you can't unsee it.
Yeah. Yeah. I had Abby Martin on a couple days ago, and we were talking about how under Bush, the left seemed sort of good. Like they were against the horrible things he was doing. That's the last time I saw the left be good. And then the right was sort of good under Obama sometimes. I mean, there was still retarded shit like the that he was a secret Muslim or didn't have a birth certificate or whatever.
Which, but, by the way, you know, I wanted him to be Muslim. I wanted to be like,
right?
And then, you know, there are so many things that happen. And I'm sorry to cut you off, Reed.
No, it's fine.
But it's come to the point where, like, you know, that Muslim fear-mongering, that really, like, bothered me a lot. And it bothered me about Republicans for so long until I finally said, fuck it. I'm just going to pretend, like, every single thing that happens in politics, there's a secret Muslim agenda happening. So, like, Trump, at one point in time, I think during early parts of COVID, the Ramadan happened, like, very, very first month or so of COVID. And it was, like, a New York Post story that said Trump is skipping lunch. I see, alhamdulillah, President Trump observing Ramadan. You'd love to see it. Like, this is, you know, fasting for Ramadan. He's not, you know, skipping lunch. He is in solidarity with us Muslims. He is the second Muslim president that we've had in the United States. So, yeah, that's, sorry, that's a weird aside. But anyways, continue.
No, it's good. But, I mean, we saw, like, a strong limited government movement under Obama. You know, there was the Tea Party movement or whatever. But then after Obama, I feel like it just all went to shit. When Trump became president, the left was just horrible. I mean, they weren't suddenly principled again. They were just complaining about the dumbest shit ever. And now that Biden is back in, instead of opposing vaccine mandates or trying to rein the government in, they care about, you know, Dr. Seuss or Mr. Potato Head getting canceled. Or so, I mean, it seems like everyone just threw the issues out and started caring about dumb cultural shit. And it seems to just escalate every time. Because I know you, I was listening to you on Michael Malice, and you said you kind of noticed this over time, that the Democrats didn't really do what they were supposed to do. Like you'd supported them, but then they kind of turned their backs on what they said they were going to do. I feel like that's just getting worse and worse and worse. And then when the opposition is in charge, the people who are being suppressed are just getting more and more retarded. They're not resisting the stuff that they're supposed to anymore. Do you kind of see it that way? Or?
Yeah, you know, it's, but like, I have to say, it could have always been like this. And maybe it's just that we're noticing it because we're becoming older and wiser. So, like, yeah, politician, you know, I hear this old, like, adage. I heard it from my uncle one time. He's like, how can you tell if a politician is lying? And the answer to that is their lips are moving. Yeah, their lips are moving. And so, like, he has always sort of held that, like, anti-government animosity, even since, like, even before the Bush days. But it was one of those things where, like, you kind of understand that politicians do not have your best interests in mind. They do not give a fuck about you. I mean, just look at this whole thing with, like, everything with COVID. You have people on the left. You have, like, the Ted Lieus, the certain Democrats who've been pushing for Medicare for all. All of a sudden start to say, hey, you know, if you're not vaccinated and you are, you're putting other people at risk and you're in the hospital and you're creating a burden on the healthcare system, you should pay more than what you're, you know, whatever's the market rate for whatever particular procedure or visit you need. And that's what justice is, because, you know, you're putting other people's lives at risk. Like, no, get the fuck out of here. Like, everybody is doing something that is, like, hurting themselves, smoking cigarettes, drinking alcohol, you know, doing illicit drugs in certain settings. And when it comes to, like, COVID, like, they are just finding an excuse to say, oh, Medicare for all. Yeah, but not for these motherfuckers right here, because they are putting everybody's lives at risk with COVID. And they probably support President Trump, and therefore they shouldn't be allowed to have health care.
Yeah.
Drives me nuts.
So what do you think about libertarians? Because you're obviously sick of the Democrats and the Republicans still have so many neocons. What do you think of us other than that we're, you know, disorganized idiots probably?
You know, libertarian, I have, you know, one of my best friends is a libertarian. He's a halfie like me. He and I have known each other since we were four. Mm-hmm. And we both come from very liberal backgrounds. And I've always been kind of like, I don't even know how to describe my own politics. I always kind of like would say I'm a moderate, but it's just, you know, to everybody else, I'm like someone with no principles. But he's like a devout libertarian. And, you know, there's certain things about libertarianism that are, you know, good in theory. But in practice, it always seems to fall apart. And that's probably because libertarians are not really... I don't know. I think there's some libertarians who are just not serious at all and just like to do it because it's cool, or they think it's, you know, part of the counterculture, or they want to like show off to people. But then again, at the same time, like if you've, I mean, like Reed, I'm sure you've met plenty of libertarians. How fucking cool are libertarians really?
Not very cool.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, when you say that it doesn't work, what do you mean? Like it can't be.
Oh, no, I'm just saying like there are things that are like, you know, constant, you know, some things that sort of go beyond the pale. Like obviously limited government is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And yet there are some libertarians who'd be like, all right, well, let's talk about age of consent laws. And like you always got to pump the brakes and be like, all right, what the fuck are you talking about? Age of consent? Really? That's the path that you want to go down? Yeah, we got to focus on that. I mean, it's just
yeah, garbage. They have they have no priorities in general, right? Like there's this low-hanging fruit that's so obvious that tons of conservatives and then a lot of liberals too will be upset about and be like, "Oh my god, this thing is so bad," and libertarians have the answer for it, and then instead they decide to go after some minutia and rip each other to shreds. Was less
like my favorite moment and my favorite video probably ever on the internet is the video from the highlight from the 2016 Libertarian National Convention, the presidential debate between Gary Johnson, Austin Peterson, and a bunch of other libertarians talking about Larry Elder asking the question, should you have a government issued license to drive a car? And you have the, you know, Austin Peterson say hell no, and then you have that one guy with sort of like the longer hair says, you know, what's next? You gotta have a license to make toast in your own damn toaster. And then the fucking beauty of that clip is Gary Johnson, who then goes on to win the nomination, saying, I don't know, I'd like to see some competency behind the wheel. And then he gets booed for that. It's just like, that's libertarianism to me in sort of a nutshell, in a practical way. But I understand, like, there are a lot of things about limited government and sort of like privatizing a lot of shit that should not be in the hands of the federal government or just any government or public sector entity that is, in theory, a great idea. Because when you have like an actual invested stake in a lot of these things and a lot of these issues, you find that private enterprise actually gets a lot of good shit done, even if some aren't like in it for, say, like the cause. Some of them are in it for the money or the bottom line. There are still a lot of people that are in it that actually want to do the right thing, and maybe that's just the optimist in me. But I can definitely buy into the idea that there are definitely a lot more things within our society that should be privatized.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because libertarians are all about markets and capitalism. But then when it comes to the market of ideas and what's at the forefront and what matters, a lot of times they fail. Like they go after the wrong issue because there's such a push for something and they'll miss it. It's just so ironic that we're all about free markets and competition, but we miss that somehow. I don't really understand that disconnect. I'm still trying to figure out why that is.
Well, actually, maybe because most people's eyes glaze over when they talk about markets. I mean, I find this shit interesting, but like, you know, to the casual observer who has no idea what libertarianism is all about and they don't know how the economy works, like the only thing they really latch onto are like the shocking social issues, like age of consent laws or fucking driver's licenses. Like, Yeah, you know, most libertarians are actually like they're socially liberal. I mean, like most of them are actually very pro-immigration, pro-same-sex marriage, pro-choice. I mean, there are a lot of things that I think if liberals probably finally understood that government is not in it to serve their interests, they only are in it to serve the government's interests and maintain power, they might actually find libertarianism more appealing.
Yeah. Yeah. So what, I mean, if you could have all the libertarians sitting in a room in front of you and you were just like, hey guys, you got to get your shit together. Focus on these five things right now. What would you tell them?
Oh, shit. Oh, that's a loaded question.
Or three, let's say three things.
You know, maybe the one thing about, I should say is, if you are going to win a major election, you need to get someone competent and charismatic enough to basically swallow up that independent voter base that hates both Republicans and Democrats and is looking for someone to put their trust in. There are too many people out there who hate both parties, and that independent, that base of independent voters is only growing because you're constantly seeing the back and forth between Democrats and Republicans and nothing getting fixed in Washington, everything always being a political issue or a sideshow, or everything's a, you know, fucking controversy. And it's just like there is ample opportunity for libertarians to, you know, actually gain some footing. And I don't know if their leadership is just too focused on principles and dealing with think tanks. But if they were actually serious about winning elections, they would have found a leader by now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I mean, an actual competent, charismatic, attractive and affable leader, and intelligent as well. The guy obviously got to be smart, but even if they're dumb as nails, then like, at least make them sound smart. I mean,
what do you think about Dave Smith? Do you know Dave well?
Or? Dave Smith. I don't know much about Dave Smith. I have been told because I went on Malice that I actually look like fat Dave Smith. So thank you, I guess. I mean,
Dave Smith. Yeah.
Look, I love to meet with Dave Smith. I hear a lot about the guy. I hear good things. I don't know any of his positions, but you know, I have to have a conversation with him first to kind of get to know the guy, because I don't like judging people before I meet them. And I'm usually one of those people who doesn't really hate anyone. I understand that, like, there are people who, you know, we're all human. We all take like controversial positions. We all have like some like unpopular opinion or even some just straight up bad opinions. I don't think that like should take away from your humanity, unless you fucking kill a person or like, you know, diddle kids. Then of course, yeah, I will definitely judge you. but like, that's the thing where it's just like, when it in the realm of politics, like, it takes a lot for me to hate somebody, unless like they're just straight up evil.
Yeah, I mean, I see the utility in running someone for president just to bring about a platform for a message that opens people's minds to a different way of thinking, kind of like when Ron Paul ran, or like when Bernie Sanders ran, whatever, like just somebody who's pushing the Overton window in a certain direction. But the actual, you know, journey to the White House, I don't see as much of a desirable or attainable goal at this point. And even if you actually got there with a libertarian president right now, I think he would just get impeached or just get blockaded by Congress or shot. I don't even, you know, I don't,
that's,
I don't
the
know.
Thing. I mean, like, the establishment is so powerful. Like, you know, I know people kind of laugh at this idea that there's a deep state, but the deep state's fucking real. I mean, like, whether you call it bureaucracy, you call it the deep state, like, that shit is real, because the powers that be, the unelected bureaucrats, the policymakers, they ensure that whoever gets elected, whether it be a Trump, whether it was a, you know, even if a Bernie Sanders ever got elected, that nothing would fucking change from the status quo. You might get a little bit of, you might get an inch pulled here and there, But by and large, like, the same shit's going to happen. And, it, you know, a lot of it has to do with when, and I wouldn't put this all on Obama. I'd say it's Obama and Bush, Bush 43, that when they both came into office, they had such a well-organized and well-oiled machine that they were able to place their people in the federal government all throughout, not only as just political appointees, but as career employees as well, to ensure that, you know, if anything should get out of order, like if you have a Donald Trump come into office and they want to fuck shit up, they want to bring a wrecking ball to the whole establishment, they have all those stopgap measures in this feedback loop that would prevent something like Trump, you know, doing everything that he wanted to do. And when you think about it, when you think about what Trump did, I mean, he was neutered. I mean, he had his wings clipped pretty early on. And he surrounded himself with people who were, you know, to his face, probably aboard his mission. But I think behind the scenes, there are a lot of people who are trying to basically knife him in the back. And they were basically establishment shills. And,
yeah.
You know, that's why I think, like, if Trump ever ran for president again, I don't actually think he would win because of how he actually performed under when he was in office. Maybe I'm sure there are Republicans who think, hey, well, it's better than Biden. Well, I mean, how much is better? I mean, I think because of a lot of the things that happened under Trump, we have this pandemic that we're still going through. And while I'm not blaming Trump specifically for the pandemic, I think there are some things that he could have done differently that would have made our lives better and didn't. And unfortunately, I think a lot of it has to do with his lack of experience in governing. And I think hiring a lot of people that didn't have America's interests in mind and were only in it for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people still have it stuck in their brains that we need to get somebody else into the White House and then everything's going to be okay, which, right. You know, you just dismantled, and I was dismantling in the question I asked you. And I think the only way around this is local politics, like, you know, taking over your state house or your town, your city council or your school board or whatever, because I mean, Washington is such a monster. You're not going to change it from the top down. I think the only way that we can change things is by taking hold of local governments and then, you know, just slowly eating away at the power that the federal government has here in Utah. Or I'm in Nevada right now, but in Utah, the business interim committee wanted to hear from the citizens of Utah what we thought about mandatory vaccination legislation from Biden. And almost 1,000 people showed up, and only a few dozen of them were in support of the vax mandates. And, you know, there's just this resounding resistance to what was going on. And I, you know, the governor has resisted Biden, and I think the legislature will now too. And, you know, I think that's a story of success, but everyone doesn't think that way. They're still thinking like, I care who the president is. I don't even know who my mayor is. I don't even know who my state representative is. I don't even know, you know, who my police chief is or any of this stuff. So we just need to get people to start thinking that way instead. Do you think that's the solution, or what do you think?
No, so here's where I actually would push back on. And I know that you mentioned like the culture war, but that's how you kind of get people sort of enthusiastic and energized about politics. It's because everything is almost everything is driven by culture. And when you take a certain position on, you know, even the most banal issue, you know, what, you know, fucking Dr. Seuss getting canceled, like that is enough to drive people to be like, how fucking stupid is this? Like, this is what we're really like talking about. that is enough to sort of move the needle for some people to be like, all right, I finally had fucking enough of this shit. It's time we actually change what we're being taught in our schools, who were elected to school board, who were elected to, you know, city council, town council, county council, you know, mayor, governor, state legislature. Like, that is like at least the first, you know, the tiny little snowball in the snowball effect. And I think continuing to fight on those culture war issues is important simply because that is just a rallying point. If you can gain some consensus on that, you can at least identify who shares similar views to you, and you can build up a network with people who may not agree with everything you say, but at least agree with you on something. And then you start building friendships with people, you start building allies, you start building networks, and then you start building coalitions. And virtually every single big time movement that has shaped the nation has come from the grassroots level. It's come from the small businesses. It's come from, the private sector. It doesn't come from the big corporations. It comes from like the small businesses. It comes from, everyday people who, go to work a 9-to-5 or work the graveyard shift. And then they, you know, they've got to pay a certain amount to Uncle Sam and see that money go to fucking a botched withdrawal in Afghanistan. Or it's just like everything about what we're seeing in this country, like the whole like Build Back Better plan. I roll my eyes at it because there's so many people who are pushing this who think it's just going to be the blanket solution that's going to like fix everything. Like, you could only throw so much money at a problem and expect it to be fixed. But that's pretty much how the U.S. government has worked, at least my entire life. And I haven't seen any change. It's just at a point you get disillusioned by all of it. And I am amazed that there are people who still believe, whether they genuinely believe it or they're paid to believe it, think that something like a $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill is going to somehow stop climate change. It's going to allow every immigrant a pathway to citizenship, and it's going to just, you know, put money in your pocket and not raise inflation, and gas prices will go down and food prices will go down. Like, that's not going to fucking happen.
Yeah. So it's almost, it's almost the point that things have to get so horrible for everyday Americans that they start caring about what's going on directly around them. Because like this vaccine mandate deal, like that was enough to get almost 1,000 people out to go protest to their local business interim committee or whatever. Like, I don't think it was the largest, protest that Utah has ever had, apparently.
And it's a lot of Mormons.
Yeah.
you put that many Mormons in the place, then you worry about the universe imploding.
But that's what it takes. Like, it takes making people uncomfortable and doing something that's personally reprehensible to them. You know, Afghanistan's never going to change their mind. The crisis at the border, unless they live in a border state near where that's happening, is never going to change the mind. It has to come down to actually threatening their comfort, and then they actually do something about it, which is why I'm sort of an accelerationist, because, you know, when it's a slow crawl and authoritarianism builds up over time, you don't see people clap back. They just kind of sit back and watch, and they don't even notice as it slowly creeps in. But I was actually almost ecstatic when Biden did his speech a few weeks ago about this vaccine mandate. I was like, yes, here we go. Now we're going to see some pushback. And sure enough, I think like 30 states have pushed back against him. But I don't know. Like, it makes me wonder where we're going, because, this pushback will be initial. But then what happens after that? Is it just going to continue? Like, what is your... What is your overall opinion on where we're headed? Do you think that we're going to have to break up, or we're just going to end up in a civil war, or things are going to end up okay? What's your general vision for the way the country's going?
I think we're already in a civil war right now, but it's not being fought with like guns and knives and fists. I think it's being fought on an information level. Like you have, you know, information warfare, the when you captivate and control people's minds and you control the message, you control the country. And I think we're already at that point where you constantly see disinformation out there. You see lying and propaganda for the government. You see disinformation, and largely there, I've seen a lot of, you know, just through the list itself, you kind of, you know, sift through these takes and you kind of understand, all right, you know, some of these people who are on Twitter either are too dumb to know what they're tweeting or they're in on it. Mm-hmm. And at that point, when you start to think that they're in on it, then you start to realize that there are a lot of forces at play that try to control people's minds by simply playing a video that's selectively edited to, you know, evoke a specific reaction, one that may evoke outrage or anger or fear, and get them to say, get a call to action where they say, make sure you vote this motherfucker out of office, or like go protest here at this, you know, time and place. It is, there is a lot of things that have been, a lot of narratives that I've seen over the course of my lifetime, as I'm sure you have, Reed, in which a lot of things that have been pushed have done so over a lot. I mean, just look at Iraq, the Iraq war, weapons of mass destruction, probably the biggest lie I think of my lifetime. And every single time, you know, it's almost like every single day that we see since then, it's almost like every single attempt made by a journalist to sort of cover up the tracks of the government, like it makes you almost like, because I worked at the Washington Examiner for about almost 5 years. Almost makes you feel like ashamed to be sort of associated with some of these people, because they're just so brazen about it. And unfortunately, journalists, and I will say this, there are a lot of good journalists out there, but every single person who is a journalist has their own biases. I have my own biases. And I think someone who is truly a good journalist, someone who is at least honest enough with themselves to at least admit that they have their own biases when covering a certain story, or at least can remove themselves from a particular story that they realize that they're probably too close to, I think those are the people who are at least worth their salt. But kind of getting back to the issue at hand with this whole idea of a civil war, you know, there's a lot of people that, you know, think that we are probably going to end in like an escalated, you know, physical military conflict where Americans are killing each other. I don't think we're going to get to that point. I still think there are a lot of people who are very disengaged and very apathetic to what's going on right now. I think there are a few people that are waking up to it. And then I think there are just a number of sheep who are probably fall into the majority who just never gave a shit. I think you and I would probably continue to be surprised at someone who still doesn't know who the vice president is. And those people exist. There's some people don't even know who the fucking president is. So it's just like, you know, some people simply cannot be saved. And I think the people who are fighting this stuff out to you know, control the message or control the narrative are large, you know, it's a very small minority of people. And the rest of the people who care still, I think, is a minority of the overall population. So do I think those people fight? you know, too soon to tell. I don't know if I can make a prediction on that, because if I do, I probably will turn out to be wrong. Especially, but like, look, the rules of the game are changing every day, and you know, double standards exist every day. And you know, something that say a Bernie Sanders supporter will do to say a congressman on a congressional baseball practice will not be, you know, Bernie Sanders won't be blamed for that shooting, but oh, if a synagogue gets shot up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, it's somehow Donald Trump's fault. Like, guys, you gotta really, like, there are so many people cherry picking these things, and it, at some point, it really just, you just got to disengage from it, from losing your own mind.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny that I never ended up on the list for any of my January 6th tweets, speaking of cherry picking, because you see so many people posting unironically that January 6th was worse than 9/11 or worse than whatever. So I don't even remember when I started doing this, but it was in March or April or May or somewhere around that. I just started comparing everything to January 6th and saying January 6th was worse than whatever. So it started out with like World War II, the Holocaust, the Holodomor, you know, Stalingrad. You know, I just like chose like every historical event that's ever happened. And then it started getting ridiculous. It was like, you know, January 6th was literally worse than when McDonald's discontinued the McRib, or like January 6th was literally worse than the Last Jedi. Or, I mean, it just started getting like stupid, but I'm surprised you never ended up finding one of those, because those that I put out, man, I probably put like 500 January 6th tweets out over the last.
But here's the thing, Reed, is I could probably see through that. Like, I could probably tell you that you're trolling with those.
Do you like go look at people's accounts and like go back through their tweets, try to figure out like
if they're trolling? Yeah, I try to. I fall short of it sometimes. Like, I think I'm looking at your tweet on its own, the John McCain name a better upgrade. Like, even for a troll, that was a pretty spicy take. And I think I probably still, you know, like, I go back and forth on this. Like, you know, Reed, he's a troll. His tweets are naturally spicy. But, like, this one, like, outspices the rest of them. And I got to put him on the list for that. Like, that is just, like,
so do you get that? Do you get any sort of reward for ratioing the list, or does that happen all the time? I'll bring up. Let's see if we got this here.
Yeah, I like to. I don't know what the ratio was. What was the ratio on that?
I got it right here. It was pretty close, but I did.
You got close.
No, I did ratio it, but let's see. All I said was, so I didn't even know what this was, but you said, "Congratulations to Reed coming in at number 6 or whatever." And I just said based, and I forgot to cut it out. I actually didn't cut it out. It's I think I got 211 likes on just saying based, and then it's got what, 190 something on there. It's pretty small.
199.
Yeah, so
that's fair. You know, like, but that's the thing. I even if you ratio that, I think there are. This is the thing, like. I think it's certainly fair to criticize anyone alive or dead. Mm-hmm. And you criticizing John McCain, you know, 3 years after his death is not a spicy take.
Right.
I think you know, maybe it was the poking at Meghan McCain's pain and her being upset was what I probably took issue with, because like if you had specifically had a tweet where it was name a bigger upgrade, and it was just John McCain from being alive to dead, like that I don't think would be spicy enough. I don't think would make the list. I think it was specifically pointing out how much pain Meghan McCain was in after her father died. And because like, look, yeah, you know, John McCain was a politician, and you know, he is not beyond reproach. He has done and advocated for a lot of bad policies that harmed a lot of people, a lot of innocent people, especially overseas, and he never really was held accountable for it. Mm-hmm. Of course, he is just one senator out of 100, and so even if he's sort of like a cheerleader for war, which he was when he was running for president in both 2000, well, specifically 2008, and I don't really remember the 2000 campaign all that well, but that's only because I was living in Pakistan at the time. It was very difficult to follow American politics there. Right. And also I was only like 12 years old. So why the fuck would I follow politics then? Anyways, kind of getting back to that, like, yeah, it's okay to like, I mean, it's not okay to wish death on politicians, but like, if you sincerely feel in your heart of hearts that like a politician is bad for the country, you know, when celebrating, when someone's dead, like, look, there are going to be a lot of people celebrating Henry Kissinger's death when he dies. I have thought about it, and I don't even think I'll list those things. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to let it be, because like, he knows what he did.
Yeah.
And people who know what he did. He's lived a long life. It's not like if he dies all of a sudden, there's no one going to be like, oh my God, I'm so upset over Henry Kissinger dying. Really? There aren't going to be that many people upset.
Right.
Maybe his immediate family. And like, yeah, they'd be going through something and just like, yeah, sorry for your loss, but like, he was really bad for the country.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just try to think of any tyrant that's responsible for killing hundreds of thousands of people, you know, and we have no remorse if they're ever made fun of. So I actually, I use the overused, you know, Hitler comparison, but after I had put that tweet out about McCain or whatever, I put one out, I forget what the wording was exactly, but I was saying, you know, I don't think we should respect genocidal maniacs and people who push for killing innocent civilians, blah, blah. And I've listed all this shit that was totally applicable to John McCain, but I just had a picture of Hitler. And so you're reading through it and you think I'm thinking about Hitler, and then it gets all the way to the bottom. And I said, oh, this is about John McCain, picture unrelated. But
yeah, I mean, like, even then, like, you know, what's interesting though is that, like, sure, maybe your target is John McCain. Mm. Like, for me, like, I would have that type of animosity and sort of anger towards George W. Bush, because right. I truly think, like, you know, whether you like him now that he's like, you know, making paintings of soldiers and hugging Michelle Obama, he was the worst fucking president of my lifetime, certainly the worst president of this side of 2000. And it doesn't even come fucking close. Like, he is the reason why I got engaged into this shit. And he is the reason why, you know, we are in this position right now. And there are many things that his administration didn't do, from not ignoring all the warnings about Al-Qaeda planning a massive attack in the United States that, you know, culminated into 9/11, from lying about weapons of mass destruction. And like, beyond that, you don't have to name a single thing else. Those were enough to convince me that he and his administration, worst thing that's ever happened for America in my lifetime or in recent memory.
Yeah, for sure.
If George W. Bush ever died, I can't list those takes. I just can't do it. I can't bring myself to do it. I would never dance on anyone's grave, but I wouldn't mourn his loss.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't expect people to appreciate those tweets or anything. Like, I completely understand anybody like being, you know, taken aback by them. I just want people to have the same amount of disgust for murdering innocent people in the Middle East, you know, or.
Yeah, and it's just like they do it with such, you know, they do it so casually. It's so blah, blah, blah to them. Like, it's just like they think that we're just supposed to be doing that. And then they have the fucking gall to say, oh, the Middle East has been fucking chaotic for decades. Like, you made it this fucking way.
Yeah.
Do you not recall, like, how after the First World War, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, you basically drew lines with France and England to, you know, divide these tribes up based on territory? Like, all of these lines were arbitrary, and you created, you know, divisions and factions and nations where they didn't need to exist. And then they just somehow act like, oh, well, you know, they've always been that way.
Yeah.
Really? Come on, bro.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we're coming up on an hour. I really appreciate you coming on, man. It's great to hear a perspective from someone who doesn't have that American exceptionalist brainwashed upbringing, who sees things in
Here's the thing, and I just want to push back on it. I do think America is the greatest country in the world, but it has its limits. Like, we are a nation not without its flaws. We definitely have too many flaws to count. And I can recognize I am very privileged to be an American and very grateful to be an American and proud to be an American. And yet I can criticize the fuck out of it because I'm an American.
Right. Yeah. So. I mean, I feel like American exceptionalism doesn't mean that, though. It usually means America can do whatever the fuck it wants.
Oh, yeah. I guess that's true. I can see what you're saying. I can see what you mean by that. But I mean, like, America could be really great. If like it really got its shit together, and like I continue to be optimistic about it because I really do feel blessed to be from here. I'm obviously feel blessed for my Pakistani heritage as well, and having an immigrant father who understands sort of like the value of freedom, even if like it is not fully practiced here in the United States to how people talk about it, because there are always like forces at play. Say you want to talk about like COVID restrictions, and not to kind of drag this on, but like I think even with all of this shit going on with COVID, I still think America is the freest country in the world.
Yeah, we're certainly beating Australia. There's no doubt there. Yeah, so I got your Twitter and your YouTube in the description, but is there anywhere else you want to plug for people to follow you, keep up with what you're doing?
So if you want to check out Habibi Bros, that is the podcast I do with Jay Mujahid Kobe. He is my co-host. We do a show Wednesday night at 9 p.m. East, and then we have a Patreon. So Habibi Bros, just go check out our Twitter at Habibi_Bros, and we'll have a new episode on Wednesday night at 9 p.m. getting drunk and talking about the news of the week.
Sweet. We got to get you on Tower Gang. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's Tower Power Hour. I'm on it with a few other guys. We got to get you on that show at some point. That would be a lot of fun.
Wow. So, BB Power Hour and Tower Power Hour. That sounds like a blast. No pun intended.
It's a crossover that has to happen for sure. So
I'll be sure to wear my vest to that read.
Well, hey, man, thanks for coming on. It was a great conversation. I'd love to have you back again.
Thanks so much, Reed. Appreciate it.